Us, huh? Those contacts are dead or worse. We killed the crown prince and left the other a whimpering idiot. The mule did not stop us there, and so much has been undone. Why, no, not at all. Those weren't our men. The crown prince was a wine-soaked mediocrity. The other man, Commerson, is phenomenally stupid. He was a power on his world, but that didn't prevent him from being vicious, evil, and completely incompetent. We had nothing really to do with them. They were, in a sense, merely feints. It was they who detained us, or tried. Again, no. Commerson had a personal slave, a man called Inchney. Detention was his policy. He is old, but will serve our temporary purpose. You would not have killed him, you see. Beta whirled on him. She had not touched her own tea. But by your very statement, your own emotions have been tampered with. You've got faith and belief in the mule, an unnatural, a diseased faith in the mule. Of what value are your opinions? You've lost all power of objective thought. You are wrong. Slowly the colonel shook his head. Only my emotions are fixed. My reason is as it always was. It may be influenced in a certain direction by my conditioned emotions, but it is not forced. And there are some things I can see more clearly now that I am freed of my earlier emotional trend. I can see that the mule's program is an intelligent and worthy one. In the time since I have been converted, I have followed his career from its start 7 years ago. With his mutant mental power, he began by winning over a conditiary and his band. With that, and his power, he won a planet. With that, and his power, he extended his grip until he could tackle the warlord of Kalgan. Each step followed the other logically. With Kalgan in his pocket, he had a first-class fleet, and with that, and his power, he could attack the Foundation. The Foundation is the key. It is the greatest area of industrial concentration in the galaxy. And now that the atomic techniques of the Foundation are in his hands, he is the actual master of the galaxy. With those techniques, and his power, he can force the remnants of the Empire to acknowledge his rule, and eventually, with the death of the old Emperor, who is mad and not long for this world, to crown him Emperor. He will then have the name as well as the fact. With that, and his power, where is the world in the galaxy that can oppose him? In these last 7 years, he has established a new empire. In 7 years, in other words, he will have accomplished what all Selden psychohistory could not have done in less than an additional 700. The galaxy will have peace and order at last. And you could not stop it, any more than you could stop a planet's rush with your shoulders. A long silence followed Pritchard's speech. What remained of his tea had grown cold. He emptied his cup, filled it again, and drained it slowly. Toran bit viciously at a thumbnail. Beta's face was cold and distant and white. Then Beta said with a thin voice, "We are not convinced. If the mule wishes us to be, let him come here and condition us himself. You fought him until the last moment of your conversion, I imagine, didn't you?"
"I did," said Colonel Pritchard solemnly.
"Then allow us the same privilege."
Colonel Pritchard arose.
With a crisp air of finality, he said, "Then I leave. As I said earlier, my mission at present concerns you in no way. Therefore, I don't think it will be necessary to report your presence here. That is not too great a kindness. If the mule wishes you stopped, he no doubt has other men assigned to the job, and you will be stopped. But for what it is worth, I shall not contribute more than my requirement."
"Thank you," said Beta faintly.
"As for Magnifico, where is he? Come out, Magnifico, I won't hurt you."
"What about him?" demanded Beta with sudden animation.
"Nothing. My instructions make no mention of him either. I have heard that he is searched for, but the mule will find him when the time suits him. I shall say nothing. Will you shake hands?"
Beta shook her head. Toran glared his frustrated contempt. There was the slightest lowering of the colonel's iron shoulders. He strode to the door, turned, and said, "One last thing. Don't think I am not aware of the source of your stubbornness. It is known that you search for the Second Foundation. The mule, in his time, will take measures. Nothing will help you. But I knew you in other times. Perhaps there is something in my conscience that urged me to this. At any rate, I tried to help you and remove you from the final danger before it was too late. Goodbye." He saluted sharply and was gone. Beta turned to a silent Toran and whispered, "They even know about the second foundation." In the recesses of the library, Ebling Miz, unaware of all, crouched under the one spark of light amid the murky spaces and mumbled triumphantly to himself. Chapter 25, Death of a Psychologist. After that, there were only 2 weeks left to the life of Ebling Miz. And in those 2 weeks, Beta was with him three times. The first time was on the night after the evening upon which they saw Colonel Pritcher. The second was 1 week later. And the third was again a week later, on the last day, the day Miz died. First, there was the night of Colonel Pritcher's evening, the first hour of which was spent by a stricken pair in a brooding, unmerry merry-go-round. Beta said, "Tori, let's tell Ebling." Toran said dully, "Think he can help? We're only two. We've got to take some of the weight off. Maybe he can help." Toran said, "He's changed. He's lost weight. He's a little feathery, a little woolly." His fingers groped in air, metaphorically. "Sometimes I don't think he'll help us much, ever. Sometimes I don't think anything will help." "Don't." Beta's voice caught and escaped a break. "Tori, don't. When you say that, I think the mule's getting us. Let's tell Ebling, Tori, now." Ebling Miz raised his head from the long desk and bleared at them as they approached. His thinning hair was scuffed up. His lips made sleepy smacking sounds. "Huh?" he said. "Someone want me?" Beta bent to her knees. "Did we wake you? Shall we leave?" "Leave? Who is it, Beta?" "No, no, stay. Aren't there chairs? I saw them." His finger pointed vaguely. Toran pushed two ahead of him. Beta sat down and took one of the psychologist's flaccid hands in hers. "May we talk to you, Doctor?" She rarely used the title. "Is something wrong?" A little sparkle returned to his abstracted eyes. His sagging cheeks regained a touch of color. "Is something wrong?" Beta said. "Captain Pritcher has been here. Let me talk, Tori. You remember Captain Pritcher, Doctor?" "Yes, yes." His fingers pinched his lips and released them. "Tall man, Democrat. Yes, he. He's discovered the mule's mutation. He was here, Doctor, and told us." "But that is nothing new. The mule's mutation is straightened out." In honest astonishment. "Haven't I told you? Have I forgotten to tell you?" "Forgotten to tell us what?" put in Toran quickly. "About the mule's mutation, of course. He tampers with emotions, emotional control. Haven't I told you? Now what made me forget?" Slowly he sucked in his under lip and considered. Then slowly, life crept into his voice, and his eyelids lifted wide, as though his sluggish brain had slid onto a well-greased single track. He spoke in a dream, looking between the two listeners rather than at them. "It is really so simple. It requires no specialized knowledge. In the mathematics of psychohistory, of course, it works out promptly. In a third-level equation involving no more... Never mind that. It can be put into ordinary words, roughly, and have it make sense, which isn't usual with psychohistorical phenomena. Ask yourselves, what can upset Harry Seldon's careful scheme of history, huh?" He peered from one to the other with a mild, questioning anxiety. "What were Seldon's original assumptions? First, that there would be no fundamental change in human society over the next 1,000 years. For instance, suppose there were a major change in the galaxy's technology, such as finding a new principle for the utilization of energy, or perfecting the study of electronic neurobiology. Social changes would render Seldon's original equations obsolete. But that hasn't happened, has it now? Or suppose that a new weapon were to be invented by forces outside the Foundation, capable of withstanding all the Foundation's armaments. That might cause a ruinous deviation, though less certainly. But even that hasn't happened. The mule's atomic field depressor was a clumsy weapon and could be countered, but that was the only novelty he presented, poor as it was. But there was a second assumption, a more subtle one. Seldon assumed that human reaction to stimuli would remain constant. Granted that the first assumption held true, then the second must have broken down. Some factor must be twisting and distorting the emotional responses of human beings, or Selden couldn't have failed, and the foundation couldn't have fallen. And what factor but the mule? Am I right? Is there a flaw in the reasoning? Beta's plump hand patted his gently. No flaw, Ebling. Miz was joyful, like a child. This and more come so easily. I tell you, I sometimes wonder what is going on inside me. I seem to recall the time when so much was a mystery to me, and now things are so clear. Problems are absent. I come across what might be one, and somehow inside me I see and understand. And my guesses, my theories, seem always to be borne out. There's a drive in me, always onward, so that I can't stop. I don't want to eat or sleep, but always go on, and on, and on. His voice was a whisper. His wasted, blue-veined hand rested tremblingly upon his forehead. There was a frenzy in his eyes that faded and went out. Then he said more quietly, "Then I never told you about the mule's mutant powers, did I? But then, did you say you knew about it?" "It was Captain Pritchard, Ebling," said Beta. "Remember?" "He told you?" There was a tinge of outrage in his tone. "But how did he find out?" "He's been conditioned by the mule. He's a colonel now, a mule's man. He came to advise us to surrender to the mule. And he told us what you told us." "Then the mule knows you're here. I must hurry. Where's Magnifico? Isn't he with you?"
"Magnifico's sleeping," said Toran impatiently. "It's past midnight, you know."
"It is? Then was I sleeping when you came in?"
"You were," said Beta decisively. "And you're not going back to work, either. You're getting into bed. Come on, Tori, help me. And you stop pushing at me, Ebling, because it's just your luck I don't shove you under a shower first. Pull off his shoes, Tori, and tomorrow you come down here and drag him out into the open air before he fades completely away. Look at you, Ebling. You'll be growing cobwebs. Are you hungry?" Ebling Miz shook his head and looked up from his cot in a peevish confusion.
I want you to send Magnifico down here tomorrow," he muttered.
Beta tucked the sheet around his neck. "You'll have me down tomorrow with washed clothes. You're going to take a good bath and then get out and visit the farm and feel a little sun on you."
"I won't do it," said Miz weakly. "You hear me? I'm too busy."
His sparse hair spread out on the pillow like a silver fringe about his head. His voice was a confidential whisper.
"You want that second foundation, don't you?"
Toran turned quickly and squatted down on the cot beside him. "What about the second foundation, Ebling?" The psychologist freed an arm from beneath the sheet, and his tired fingers clutched at Toran's sleeve. "The foundations were established at a great psychological convention presided over by Harry Selden. Toran, I have located the published minutes of that convention. 25 fat films. I have already looked through various summaries."
"Well?"
"Well, do you know that it is very easy to find from them the exact location of the first foundation, if you know anything at all about psychohistory? It is frequently referred to, when you understand the equations. But, Toran, nobody mentions the second foundation. There has been no reference to it anywhere."
Toran's eyebrows pulled into a frown.
"Then it doesn't exist?"
"Of course it exists," cried Miz angrily.
"Who said it didn't?
But there's less talk of it. Its significance and all about it are better hidden, better obscured. Don't you see? It's the more important of the two. It's the critical one, the one that counts. And I've got the minutes of the Selden Convention. The mule hasn't won yet."
Quietly, Beta turned the lights down. "Go to sleep." Without speaking, Toran and Beta made their way up to their own quarters. The next day, Ebling Miz bathed and dressed himself, saw the sun of Trantor and felt the wind of Trantor for the last time. At the end of the day, he was once again submerged in the gigantic recesses of the library, and never emerged thereafter. In the week that followed, life settled again into its groove. The sun of Neo Trantor was a calm, bright star in Trantor's night sky. The farm was busy with its spring planting. The university grounds were silent in their desertion. The galaxy seemed empty. The mule might never have existed. Beta was thinking that as she watched Toran light his cigar carefully and look up at the sections of blue sky visible between the swarming metal spires that encircled the horizon. "It's a nice day," he said.
"Yes, it is. Have you everything mentioned on that list, Tori?"
"Sure.
Half-pound butter, dozen eggs, string beans. Got it all down here, Bay. I'll have it right.
Good. And make sure the vegetables are of the last harvest and not museum relics. Did you see Magnifico anywhere, by the way?
Not since breakfast. Guess he's down with Ebling, watching a book film.
All right. Don't waste any time, because I'll need the eggs for dinner.
Toran left with a backward smile and a wave of the hand. Beta turned away as Toran slid out of sight among the maze of metal. She hesitated before the kitchen door, about-faced slowly, and entered the colonnade leading to the elevator that burrowed down into the recesses.
Ebling Miz was there, head bent down over the eyepiece of the projector, motionless, a frozen, questing body. Near him sat Magnifico, screwed up into a chair, eyes sharp and watching, a bundle of slatty limbs with a nose emphasizing his scrawny face. Beta said softly, "Magnifico?"
Magnifico scrambled to his feet. His voice was an eager whisper.
"My lady!"
"Magnifico," Beta said. "Toran has left for the farm and won't be back for a while. Would you be a good boy and go out after him with a message that I'll write for you?"
"Gladly, my lady. My small services are but too eagerly yours for the tiny uses you can put them to."
She was alone with Ebling Miz, who had not moved. Firmly she placed her hand upon his shoulder.
"Ebling?"
The psychologist started with a peevish cry.
"What is it?"
He wrinkled his eyes.
Is it you, Beta? Where's Magnifico?"
"I sent him away. I want to be alone with you for a while." She enunciated her words with exaggerated distinctness.
"I want to talk to you, Ebling."
The psychologist made a move to return to his projector, but her hand on his shoulder was firm. She felt the bone under the sleeve clearly. The flesh seemed to have fairly melted away since their arrival on Trantor. His face was thin, yellowish, and bore a half-weak stubble. His shoulders were visibly stooped, even in a sitting position.
Beta said, "Magnifico isn't bothering you, is he, Ebling? He seems to be down here night and day."
"No, no, no, not at all. Well, I don't mind him. He's silent and never disturbs me. Sometimes he carries the films back and forth for me. Seems to know what I want without my speaking. Just let him be."
"Very well. But, Ebling, doesn't he make you wonder? Do you hear me, Ebling? Doesn't he make you wonder?"
She jerked a chair close to his and stared at him as though to pull the answer out of his eyes. Ebling Miz shook his head.
"No. What do you mean?"
"I mean that Colonel Pritcher and you both say the mule can condition the emotions of human beings. But are you sure of it? Isn't Magnifico himself a flaw in the theory?"
There was silence.
Beta repressed a strong desire to shake the psychologist.
"What's wrong with you, Ebling? Magnifico was the mule's clown. Why wasn't he conditioned to love and faith? Why should he, of all those in contact with the mule, hate him so?"
But he was conditioned."
"Certainly, Bay."
He seemed to gather certainty as he spoke.
"Do you suppose that the mule treats his clown the way he treats his generals? He needs faith and loyalty in the latter, but in his clown he only needs fear. Didn't you ever notice that Magnifico's continual state of panic is pathological in nature? Do you suppose it is natural for a human being to be as frightened as that all the time? Fear to such an extent becomes comic. It was probably comic to the mule. And helpful, too, since it obscured what help we might have gotten earlier from Magnifico."
Beta said, "You mean Magnifico's information about the mule was false?"
"It was misleading. It was colored by pathological fear. The mule is not the physical giant Magnifico thinks. He is more probably an ordinary man outside his mental powers. But if it amused him to appear a superman to poor Magnifico..." The psychologist shrugged. "In any case, Magnifico's information is no longer of importance."
"What is, then?"
But Miz shook himself loose and returned to his projector.
"What is, then?" she repeated. "The second foundation?"
The psychologist's eyes jerked towards her.
"Have I told you anything about that? I don't remember telling you anything. I'm not ready yet. What have I told you?"
"Nothing," said Beta intensely.
"Oh, Galaxy, you've told me nothing, but I wish you would because I'm deathly tired. When will it be over?"
Ebling Miz peered at her, vaguely rueful.
"Well, now, my dear, I did not mean to hurt you. I forget sometimes who my friends are."
This book is concluded on the other side of this cassette.
"Well, now, my dear, I did not mean to hurt you.
I forget sometimes who my friends are. Sometimes it seems to me that I must not talk of all this. There's a need for secrecy, but from the mule, not from you, my dear. He patted her shoulder with a weak amiability. She said, "What about the second foundation?" His voice was automatically a whisper, thin and sibilant. "Do you know the thoroughness with which Selden covered his traces? The proceedings of the Selden Convention would have been of no use to me at all as little as a month ago, before this strange insight came. Even now it seems tenuous. The papers put out by the Convention are often apparently unrelated, always obscure. More than once I wondered if the members of the Convention themselves knew all that was in Selden's mind. Sometimes I think he used the Convention only as a gigantic front and single-handed erected the structure of the foundations," urged Beta. "Of the second foundation. Our foundation was simple, but the second foundation was only a name. It was mentioned, but if there was any elaboration, it was hidden deep in the mathematics. There is still much I don't even begin to understand, but for 7 days the bits have been clumping together into a vague picture. Foundation number one was a world of physical scientists. It represented a concentration of the dying sciences of the galaxy under the conditions necessary to make it live again. No psychologists were included. It was a peculiar distortion and must have had a purpose. The usual explanation was that Selden's psychohistory worked best where the individual working units, human beings, had no knowledge of what was coming and could therefore react naturally to all situations. Do you follow me, my dear?" "Yes, doctor." "Then listen carefully. Foundation number two was a world of mental scientists. It was the mirror image of our world. Psychology, not physics, was king." Triumphantly. "You see?" "I don't." "But think, Beta, use your head. Harry Selden knew that his psychohistory could predict only probabilities and not certainties. There was always a margin of error, and as time passed, that margin increases in geometric progression. Selden would naturally guard as well as he could against it. Our foundation was scientifically vigorous. It could conquer armies and weapons. It could pit force against force. But what of the mental attack of a mutant such as the mule?" "That would be for the psychologists of the second foundation." Beta felt excitement rising within her. "Yes, yes, yes, certainly. But they have done nothing so far. How do you know they haven't?" Beta considered that. "I don't. Do you have evidence that they are?" "No. There are many factors I know nothing of. The second foundation could not have been established full-grown any more than we were. We developed slowly and grew in strength. They must have also. The stars know at what stage their strength is now. Are they strong enough to fight the mule? Are they aware of the danger in the first place? Have they capable leaders? But if they follow Selden's plan, then the mule must be beaten by the second foundation." "Ah," and Ebling Miz's thin face wrinkled thoughtfully. "Is it that again? But the second foundation was a more difficult job than the first. Its complexity is hugely greater, and consequently so is its possibility of error. And if the second foundation should not beat the mule, it is bad, ultimately bad. It is the end, maybe, of the human race as we know it." "No, yes. If the mule's descendants inherit his mental powers. You see, Homo sapiens could not compete. There would be a new dominant race, a new aristocracy, with Homo sapiens demoted to slave labor as an inferior race. Isn't that so?" "Yes, that is so. And even if by some chance the mule did not establish a dynasty, he would still establish a distorted new empire upheld by his personal power only. It would die with his death. The galaxy would be left where it was before he came, except that there would no longer be foundations around, which a real and healthy second empire would coalesce. It would mean thousands of years of barbarism. It would mean no end in sight. What can we do? Can we warn the second foundation? We must, or they may go under through ignorance, which we cannot risk. But there is no way of warning them." "No way? I don't know where they're located. They are at the other end of the galaxy, but that is all, and there are millions of worlds to choose from." "But Ebling, don't they say?" She pointed vaguely at the films that covered the table. "No, they don't. Not where I can find it. Yet. The secrecy must mean something. There must be a reason." A puzzled expression returned to his eyes. But I wish you'd leave. I've wasted enough time, and it's growing short. It's growing short." He tore away, petulant and frowning. Magnifico's soft step approached. "Your husband is home, my lady." Ebling Miz did not greet the clown.
He was back at his projector. That evening, Toran, having listened, spoke. "And you think he's really right, Bay? You think he isn't..." He hesitated. "He is right, Tori. He's sick, I know that. The change that's come over him, the loss in weight, the way he speaks, he's sick. But as soon as the subject of the mule or the second foundation or anything he is working on comes up, listen to him. He is lucid and clear as the sky of outer space. He knows what he's talking about. I believe him. Then there's hope." It was half a question. I haven't worked it out. Maybe, maybe not. I'm carrying a blaster from now on." The shiny-barreled weapon was in her hand as she spoke. "Just in case, Tori, just in case." "In case what?" Beta laughed with a touch of hysteria. "Never mind. Maybe I'm a little crazy, too, like Ebling Miz." Ebling Miz at that time had 7 days to live, and the 7 days slipped by, one after the other, quietly. To Taran, there was a quality of stupor about them. The warming days and the dull silence covered him with lethargy. All life seemed to have lost its quality of action and changed into an infinite sea of hibernation. Miz was a hidden entity whose burrowing work produced nothing and did not make itself known. He had barricaded himself. Neither Toran nor Beta could see him. Only Magnifico's go-between characteristics were evidence of his existence. Magnifico, grown silent and thoughtful, with his tiptoed trays of food and his still, watchful witness in the gloom. Beta was more and more a creature of herself. The vivacity died. The self-assured competence wavered. She, too, sought her own worried, absorbed company. And once Toran had come upon her, fingering her blaster, she had put it away quickly, forced a smile. "What are you doing with it, Bay?" "Holding it. Is that a crime?" "You'll blow your fool head off." "Then I'll blow it off. Small loss." Married life had taught Toran the futility of arguing with a female in a dark brown mood. He shrugged and left her. On the last day, Magnifico scampered breathless into their presence. He clutched at them, frightened. "The learned doctor calls for you. He is not well." And he wasn't well. He was in bed, his eyes unnaturally large, unnaturally bright. He was dirty, unrecognizable. "Ebling," cried Beta. "Let me speak," croaked the psychologist, lifting his weight to a thin elbow with an effort. "Let me speak. I'm finished. The work I pass on to you. I have kept no notes. The scrap figures I have destroyed. No other must know. All must remain in your minds." "Magnifico," said Beta with rough directness. "Go upstairs." Reluctantly, the clown rose and took a backward step. His sad eyes were on Miz. Miz gestured weakly. "He doesn't matter. Let him stay. Stay, Magnifico." The clown sat down quickly. Beta gazed at the floor. Slowly, slowly, her lip caught in her teeth. Miz said in a hoarse whisper, "I am convinced the Second Foundation can win if it is not caught prematurely by the mule. It has kept itself secret. The secrecy must be upheld. It has a purpose. You must go there. Your information is vital. May make all the difference. Do you hear me?" Toran cried in near agony. "Yes, yes. Tell us how to get there, Ebling. Where is it?" "I can tell you," said the faint voice. He never did. Beta, face frozen white, lifted her blaster and shot with an echoing clap of noise. From the waist upward, Miz was not, and a ragged hole was in the wall behind. From numb fingers, Beta's blaster dropped to the floor. Chapter 26. End of the Search. There was not a word to be said. The echoes of the blast rolled away into the outer rooms and rumbled downward into a hoarse, dying whisper. Before its death, it had muffled the sharp clamor of Beta's falling blaster, smothered Magnifico's high-pitched cry, drowned out Toran's inarticulate roar. There was a silence of agony. Beta's head was bent into obscurity. A droplet caught the light as it fell. Beta had never wept before. Toran's muscles almost cracked in their spasm, but he did not relax. He felt as if he would never unclench his teeth again. Magnifico's face was a faded, lifeless mask. Finally, from between teeth still tight, Toran choked out in an unrecognizable voice, "You're a mule's woman, then. He got to you." Beta looked up, and her mouth twisted with a painful merriment. I, a mule's woman? That's ironic. She smiled, a brittle effort, and tossed her hair back. Slowly, her voice verged back to the normal, or something near it. It's over, Toran. I can talk now. How much I will survive, I don't know, but I can start talking. Toran's tension had broken of its own weight and faded into a flaccid dullness. Talk about what, Bay? What's there to talk about? About the calamity that's followed us. We've remarked about it before, Tori, don't you remember? How defeat has always bitten at our heels and never actually managed to nip us? We were on the Foundation, and it collapsed while the independent traders still fought, but we got out in time to go to Haven. We were on Haven, and it collapsed while the others still fought, and again, we got out in time. We went to Neo-Trantor, and by now it's undoubtedly joined the Mule. Toran listened and shook his head. I don't understand. Tori, such things don't happen in real life. You and I are insignificant people. We don't fall from one vortex of politics into another continuously for the space of a year, unless we carry the vortex with us. Unless we carry the source of infection with us. Now do you see? Toran's lips tightened, his glance fixed horribly upon the bloody remnants of what had once been a human, and his eyes sickened. Let's get out of here, Bay. Let's get out into the open. It was cloudy outside. The wind scudded about them in drab spurts and disordered Beta's hair. Magnifico had crept after them, and now he hovered at the edge of their conversation. Toran said tightly, You killed Ebling Miz because you believed him to be the focus of infection? Something in her eyes struck him. He whispered, He was the mule? He did not, could not believe the implications of his own words. Beta laughed sharply. Poor Ebling the mule? Galaxy, no. I couldn't have killed him if he were the mule. He would have detected the emotion accompanying the move and changed it for me to love, devotion, admiration, terror, whatever he pleased. No, I killed Ebling because he was not the mule. I killed him because he knew where the second foundation was, and in 2 seconds he would have told the mule the secret. Would have told the mule the secret, Toran repeated stupidly. Told the mule? And then he emitted a sharp cry, and turned to stare in horror at the clown, who might have been crouching unconscious there for the apparent understanding he had of what he heard. Not Magnifico, Toran whispered the question. Listen, said Beta. Do you remember what happened on Neo-Trantor? Think for yourself, Tori. But he shook his head and mumbled at her. She went on wearily. A man died on Neo-Trantor. A man died with no one touching him, isn't that true? Magnifico played on his Visisonar, and when he was finished, the Crown Prince was dead. Now, isn't that strange? Isn't it queer that a creature afraid of everything, apparently helpless with terror, has the capacity to kill at will? The music and the light effect, said Toran, have a profound emotional effect. Yes, an emotional effect. A pretty big one. Emotional effects happen to be the mule's specialty. That, I suppose, can be considered a coincidence. And a creature who can kill by suggestion is so full of fright. Well, the mule tampered with his mind, supposedly, so that can be explained. But Toran, I caught a little of that Visisonar selection that killed the Crown Prince. Just a little. But it was enough to give me that same feeling of despair I had in the Time Vault on Haven. Toran, I can't mistake that particular feeling. Toran's face was darkening. I felt it too. I forgot. I never thought it was then that it first occurred to me. It was just a vague feeling, intuition, if you like. I had nothing to go on. And then Pritchard told us of the mule and his mutation, and it was clear in a moment. It was the mule who had created the despair in the Time Vault. It was Magnifico who had created the despair on Neo-Trantor. It was the same emotion. Therefore, the mule and Magnifico were the same person. Doesn't it work out nicely, Tori? Isn't it just like an axiom in geometry? Things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. She was at the edge of hysteria, but dragged herself back to sobriety by main force. She continued, The discovery scared me to death. If Magnifico were the mule, he could know my emotions and cure them for his own purposes. I dared not let him know. I avoided him. Luckily, he avoided me also. He was too interested in Ebling Miz. I planned killing Miz before he could talk.
I planned it secretly, as secretly as I could. So secretly I didn't dare tell it to myself. If I could have killed the mule himself. But I couldn't take the chance. He would have noticed.
And I would have lost everything. She seemed drained of emotion. Taran said harshly and with finality, "It's impossible. Look at the miserable creature. He, the mule? He doesn't even hear what we're saying." But when his eyes followed his pointing finger, Magnifico was erect and alert, his eyes sharp and darkly bright. His voice was without a trace of an accent. "I hear her, my friend. It is merely that I have been sitting here and brooding on the fact that with all my cleverness and forethought, I could make a mistake and lose so much." Taran stumbled backward as if afraid the clown might touch him or that his breath might contaminate him. Magnifico nodded and answered the unspoken question. "I am the mule." He seemed no longer a grotesque. His pipe-stem legs, his beak of a nose lost their humor-compelling qualities. His fear was gone. His bearing was firm. He was in command of the situation with an ease born of usage. He said tolerantly, "Seat yourselves. Go ahead, you might as well sprawl out and make yourselves comfortable. The game's over, and I'd like to tell you a story. It's a weakness of mine. I want people to understand me." And his eyes, as he looked at Beta, were still the old, soft, sad brown ones of Magnifico, the clown. "There is nothing really to my childhood," he began, plunging bodily into quick, impatient speech, "that I care to remember. Perhaps you can understand that. My meagerness is glandular, my nose I was born with. It was not possible for me to lead a normal childhood. My mother died before she saw me. I do not know my father. I grew up haphazard, wounded and tortured in mind, full of self-pity and hatred of others. I was known then as a queer child. All avoided me, most out of dislike, some out of fear. Queer incidents occurred. Well, never mind. Enough happened to enable Captain Pritcher, in his investigation of my childhood, to realize that I was a mutant, which was more than I ever realized until I was in my 20s. Taran and Beta listened distantly. The wash of his voice broke over them, seated on the ground as they were, unheeded almost. The clown, or the mule, paced before them with little steps, speaking downward to his own folded arms. "The whole notion of my unusual power seems to have broken on me slowly in such sluggish steps. Even toward the end, I couldn't believe it. To me, men's minds are dials, with pointers that indicate the prevailing emotion. It is a poor picture, but how else can I explain it? Slowly I learned that I could reach into those minds and turn the pointer to the spot I wished, that I could nail it there forever. And then it took even longer to realize that others couldn't. But the consciousness of power came, and with it the desire to make up for the miserable position of my earlier life. Maybe you can understand it. Maybe you can try to understand it. It isn't easy to be a freak, to have a mind and an understanding and be a freak. Laughter and cruelty, to be different, to be an outsider. You've never been through it." Magnifico looked up to the sky and teetered on the balls of his feet and reminisced stonily. "But I eventually did learn, and I decided that the galaxy and I could take turns. Come, they had their innings, and I had been patient about it for 22 years. My turn. It would be up to the rest of you to take it, and the odds would be fair enough for the galaxy. One of me, trillions of them." He paused to glance at Beta swiftly. "But I had a weakness. I was nothing in myself. If I could gain power, it could only be by means of others. Success came to me through middlemen. Always. It was as Pritcher said. Through a pirate, I obtained my first asteroidal base of operations. Through an industrialist, I got my first foothold on a planet. Through a variety of others, ending with the warlord of Kalgan, I won Kalgan itself and got a navy. After that, it was the Foundation. And you two come into the story. The Foundation," he said softly, "was the most difficult task I had met. To beat it, I would have to win over, break down, or render useless an extraordinary proportion of its ruling class. I could have done it from scratch, but a shortcut was possible, and I looked for it. After all, if a strong man can lift 500 pounds, it does not mean that he is eager to do so continuously. My emotional control is not an easy task. I prefer not to use it, where not fully necessary. So I accepted allies in my first attack upon the Foundation. As my clown, I looked for the agent or agents of the Foundation that must inevitably have been sent to Kalgan to investigate my humble self. I know now it was Han Pritcher I was looking for. By a stroke of fortune, I found you instead. I am a telepath, but not a complete one. And, my lady, you were from the Foundation. I was led astray by that. It was not fatal, for Pritchard joined us afterward, but it was the starting point of an error which was fatal. Torrance stirred for the first time. He spoke in an outraged tone. Hold on now. You mean that when I outfaced that lieutenant on Calgan with only a stun pistol and rescued you, that you had emotionally controlled me into it? He was spluttering. You mean I've been tampered with all along? A thin smile played on Magnifico's face. Why not? You don't think it's likely? Ask yourself then, would you have risked death for a strange grotesque you had never seen before if you had been in your right mind? I imagine you were surprised at events in cold afterblood. Yes, said Beta distantly. He was. It's quite plain. As it was, continued the mule, Torran was in no danger. The lieutenant had his own strict instructions to let us go. So the three of us and Pritchard went to the Foundation. And see how my campaign shaped itself instantly. When Pritchard was court-martialed and we were present, I was busy. The military judges of that trial later commanded their squadrons in the war. They surrendered rather easily, and my navy won the Battle of Horliger and other lesser affairs. Through Pritchard, I met Dr. Miz, who brought me a visisonar entirely of his own accord and simplified my task immensely. Only it wasn't entirely of his own accord. Beta interrupted. Those concerts. I've been trying to fit them in. Now I see. Yes, said Magnifico. The visisonar acts as a focusing device. In a way, it is a primitive device for emotional control in itself. With it, I can handle people in quantity and single people more intensively. The concerts I gave on Terminus before it fell and Haven before it fell contributed to the general defeatism. I might have made the Crown Prince of Neotrantor very sick without the visisonar, but I could not have killed him. You see? But it was Ebling Miss who was my most important find. He might have been, Magnifico said it with chagrin, then hurried on. There is a special facet to emotional control you do not know about. Intuition or insight, or hunch tendency, whatever you wish to call it, can be treated as an emotion. At least I can treat it so. You don't understand it, do you? He waited for no negative. The human mind works at low efficiency. 20% is the figure usually given. When momentarily there is a flash of greater power, it is termed a hunch, or insight, or intuition. I found early that I could induce a continual use of high brain efficiency. It is a killing process for the person affected, but it is useful. The atomic field depressor, which I used in the war against the Foundation, was the result of high-pressuring a Calgan technician. Again, I worked through others. Ebling Miss was the bullseye. His potentialities were high, and I needed him. Even before my war with the Foundation had opened, I had already sent delegates to negotiate with the Empire. It was at that time I began my search for the second Foundation. Naturally, I didn't find it. Naturally, I knew that I must find it, and Ebling Miz was the answer. With his mind at high efficiency, he might possibly have duplicated the work of Harry Seldon. Partly he did. I drove him to the utter limit. The process was ruthless, but it had to be completed. He was dying at the end, but he lived. Again, his chagrin interrupted him. He would have lived long enough. Together we three could have gone onward to the second Foundation. It would have been the last battle, but for my mistake. Taran stirred his voice to hardness. Why do you stretch it out so? What was your mistake? And have done with your speech. Why, your wife was the mistake. Your wife was an unusual person. I had never met her like before in my life. Quite suddenly, Magnifico's voice broke. He recovered with difficulty. There was a grimness about him as he continued. She liked me without my having to juggle her emotions. She was neither repelled by me nor amused by me. She pitied me. She liked me. Don't you understand? Can't you see what that would mean to me? Never before had anyone... Well, I cherished that. My own emotions played me false, though I was master of all others. I stayed out of her mind, you see. I did not tamper with it. I cherished the natural feeling too greatly. It was my mistake. The first. You, Taran, were under control. You never suspected me, never questioned me, never saw anything peculiar or strange about me. As, for instance, when the Felian ship stopped us. They knew our location, by the way, because I was in communication with them, as I've remained in communication with my generals at all times. When they stopped us, I was taken aboard to adjust Han Pritchard, who was on it as prisoner. When I left, he was a colonel, a mule's man, and in command. The whole procedure was too open even for you, Taran.
Yet you accepted my explanation of the matter, which was full of fallacies. See what I mean?
Taran grimaced and challenged him. How did you retain communications with your generals?
There was no difficulty to it. Ultra-wave senders are easy to handle and eminently portable. Nor could I be detected in a real sense. Anyone who did catch me in the act would leave me with a slice gapped out of his memory. It happened on occasion. On Neo Trantor, my own foolish emotions betrayed me again. Beta was not under my control, but even so might never have suspected me if I had kept my head about the Crown Prince. His intentions toward Beta annoyed me. I killed him. It was a foolish gesture. An unobtrusive fight would have served as well. And still your suspicions would not have been certainties if I had stopped Pritcher in his well-intentioned babbling, or paid less attention to Miz and more to you. He shrugged.
That's the end of it? Asked Beta.
That's the end.
What now, then?
I'll continue with my program. That I'll find another as adequately brained and trained as Ebling Miz in these degenerate days, I doubt. I shall have to search for the second foundation otherwise. In a sense, you have defeated me.
And now Beta was upon her feet, triumphant.
In a sense? Only in a sense? We have defeated you entirely. All your victories outside the Foundation count for nothing, since the galaxy is a barbarian vacuum now. The Foundation itself is only a minor victory, since it wasn't meant to stop your variety of crisis. It's the second Foundation you must beat, the second Foundation. And it's the second Foundation that will defeat you. Your only chance was to locate it and strike it before it was prepared. You won't do that now. Every minute from now on, they'll be readier for you.
At this moment, the machinery may have started. You'll know when it strikes you, and your short term of power will be over, and you'll be just another strutting conqueror, flashing quickly and meanly across the bloody face of history.
She was breathing hard, nearly gasping in her vehemence.
And we've defeated you, Taran and I. I am satisfied to die.
But the mule's sad brown eyes were the sad brown loving eyes of Magnifico.
I won't kill you or your husband. It is, after all, impossible for you two to hurt me further. And killing you won't bring back Ebling Miz. My mistakes were my own, and I take responsibility for them. Your husband and yourself may leave. Go in peace, for the sake of what I call friendship.
Then, with a sudden touch of pride,
and meanwhile, I am still the mule, the most powerful man in the galaxy. I shall still defeat the Second Foundation.
And Beta shot her last arrow with a firm, calm certitude.
You won't. I have faith in the wisdom of Selden yet. You shall be the last ruler of your dynasty as well as the first.
Something caught Magnifico.
Of my dynasty? Yes, I had thought of that often, that I might establish a dynasty, that I might have a suitable consort.
Beta suddenly caught the meaning of the look in his eyes and froze horribly.
Magnifico shook his head.
I sense your revulsion, but that's silly. If things were otherwise, I could make you happy very easily. It would be an artificial ecstasy, but there would be no difference between it and the genuine emotion. But things are not otherwise. I call myself the mule, but not because of my strength, obviously.
He left them, never looking back.
This concludes the reading of Foundation and Empire by Isaac Asimov. This book was read by Dan Lazar. Will you please wind this final tape fully forward so the book will be ready for the next person to enjoy? Thank you.
Foundation's Edge by Isaac Asimov. Copyright 1982 by Nightfall Incorporated. The fourth novel in the Foundation series. This book contains 367 pages in 20 chapters and an afterword. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. It is 498 years since the establishment of the first Foundation. The threat of the mule has been rebuffed. On Trantor, it is a period of calm and prosperity. But an unexpected appearance by psychohistorian Harry Selden raises some interesting questions, and the young councilman who asks them finds himself exiled into space in search of answers. Does the Second Foundation still exist, and does it continue to control human history from a secret galactic refuge? At issue, the destiny of humankind. Foundation's Edge is the most eagerly anticipated science fiction novel of our time. It is the first science fiction novel from The Master in a decade, a stirring blend of actions and ideas with future technology and hyperspace travel. The sequel to the Foundation trilogy has all the wisdom, humor, and intrigue that have made its predecessors the most widely read science fiction series of all time. Asimov has done his classic threesome one better. Dedicated to Betty Prashker, who insisted, and to Lester Del Rey, who nagged. Prologue. The First Galactic Empire was falling. It had been decaying and breaking down for centuries, and only one man fully realized that fact. He was Harry Seldon, the last great scientist of the First Empire, and it was he who perfected psychohistory, the science of human behavior reduced to mathematical equations. The individual human being is unpredictable, but the reactions of human mobs, Seldon found, could be treated statistically. The larger the mob, the greater the accuracy that could be achieved. And the size of the human masses that Seldon worked with was no less than the population of all the inhabited millions of worlds of the galaxy. Seldon's equations told him that left to itself, the empire would fall, and that 30,000 years of human misery and agony would elapse before a second empire would arise from the ruins. And yet, if one could adjust some of the conditions that existed, that interregnum could be decreased to a single millennium, just 1,000 years. It was to ensure this that Seldon set up two colonies of scientists that he called foundations. With deliberate intention, he set them up, quote, at opposite ends of the galaxy. The first foundation, which centered on physical science, was set up in the full daylight of publicity. The existence of the other, the second foundation, a world of psychohistorical and mentalic scientists, was drowned in silence. In the Foundation trilogy, the story of the first four centuries of the interregnum is told. The first foundation, commonly known as simply the Foundation, since the existence of another was unknown to almost all, began as a small community lost in the emptiness of the outer periphery of the galaxy. Periodically, it faced a crisis in which the variables of human intercourse and of the social and economic currents of the time constricted about it. Its freedom to move lay along only one certain line, and when it moved in that direction, a new horizon of development opened before it. All had been planned by Harry Seldon, long dead now. The first foundation, with its superior science, took over the barbarized planets that surrounded it. It faced the anarchic warlords who broke away from the dying empire and beat them. It faced the remnant of the empire itself under its last strong emperor and its last strong general and beat it. It seemed as though the Seldon plan was going through smoothly and that nothing would prevent the second empire from being established on time and with a minimum of intermediate devastation. But psychohistory is a statistical science. Always there is a small chance that something will go wrong, and something did, something which Harry Seldon could not have foreseen. One man, called the Mule, appeared from nowhere. He had mental powers in a galaxy that lacked them. He could mold men's emotions and shape their minds so that his bitterest opponents were made into his devoted servants. Armies could not, would not, fight him. The first foundation fell, and Seldon's plan seemed to lie in ruins. There was left the mysterious second foundation, which had been caught unprepared by the sudden appearance of the Mule, but which was now slowly working out a counterattack. Its great defense was the fact of its unknown location. The Mule sought it in order to make his conquest of the galaxy complete. The faithful of what was left of the first foundation sought it to obtain help. Neither found it. The Mule was stopped first by the action of a woman, Beta Durell, and that bought enough time for the second foundation to organize the proper action, and with that, to stop the Mule permanently. Slowly, they prepared to reinstate the Seldon plan. But in a way, the cover of the second foundation was gone. The first foundation knew of the second's existence, and the first did not want a future in which they were overseen by the mentalists. The first foundation was the superior in physical force, while the second foundation was hampered not only by that fact, but by being faced by a double task. It had not only to stop the first foundation, but had also to regain its anonymity. This the second foundation, under its greatest first speaker, Preem Palver, managed to do. The first foundation was allowed to seem to win, to seem to defeat the second foundation, and it moved on to greater and greater strength in the galaxy, totally ignorant that the second foundation still existed. It is now 498 years after the first foundation had come into existence. It is at the peak of its strength, but one man does not accept appearances. Chapter 1. Councilman. I don't believe it, of course, said Golan Trevise, standing on the wide steps of Seldon Hall and looking out over the city as it sparkled in the sunlight. Terminus was a mild planet with a high water-land ratio. The introduction of weather control had made it all the more comfortable and considerably less interesting, Trevise often thought. I don't believe any of it, he repeated and smiled. His white, even teeth gleamed out of his youthful face. His companion and fellow consulant, Mun Lee Kamphor, who had adopted a middle name in defiance of Terminus tradition, shook his head uneasily. "What, don't you believe that we saved the city?" "Oh, I believe that. We did, didn't we? And Selden said that we would, and he said we would be right to do so, and that he knew all about it 500 years ago. Kamphor's voice dropped, and he said in a half-whisper, "Look, I don't mind your talking like this to me, because I take it as just talk, but if you shout it out in crowds, others will hear, and frankly, I don't want to be standing near you when the lightning strikes. I'm not sure how precise the aim will be." Trevise's smile did not waver. He said, "Is there harm in saying that the city is saved and that we did it without a war?" "There was no one to fight," said Kamphor. He had hair of a buttery yellow, eyes of a sky blue, and he always resisted the impulse to alter those unfashionable hues. "Have you never heard of civil war, Kamphor?" said Trevise. He was tall. His hair was black, with a gentle wave to it, and he had a habit of walking with his thumbs hitched into the soft fibered sash he always wore. "A civil war over the location of the capital?" The question was enough to bring on a Selden crisis. It destroyed Hannes' political career. It put you and me into the council last election, and the issue hung. He twisted one hand slowly back and forth, like a balance coming to rest on the level. He paused on the steps, ignoring the other members of the government and the media, as well as the fashionable society types who had finagled an invitation to witness Selden's return, or the return of his image, at any rate. All were walking down the stairs, talking, laughing, glorying in the correctness of everything, and basking in Selden's approval. Trevise stood still and let the crowd swirl past him. Kamphor, having walked 2 steps ahead, paused, an invisible cord stretching between them. He said, "Aren't you coming?" "There's no hurry. They won't start the council meeting until Mayor Brano has reviewed the situation in her usual flat-footed one-syllable-at-a-time way. I'm in no hurry to endure another ponderous speech. Look at the city." "I see it. I saw it yesterday, too." "Yes, but did you see it 500 years ago when it was founded?"
498, Kamphor corrected him automatically.
2 years from now, they'll have the hemi-millennial celebration, and Mayor Brano will still be in the office at the time, barring events of, we hope, minor probability."
"We hope," said Trevise dryly. "But what was it like 500 years ago when it was founded? One city, one small city occupied by a group of men preparing an encyclopedia that was never finished." "Of course it was finished."
"Are you referring to the Encyclopedia Galactica we have now? What we have isn't what they were working on. What we have is in a computer, and it's revised daily. Have you ever looked at the uncompleted original?"
"You mean in the Hardin Museum?"
"The Salvar Hardin Museum of Origins. Let's have the full name, please, since you're so careful about exact dates. Have you looked at it?"
"No. Why should I?"
"No, it isn't worth it. But anyway, there they were, a group of encyclopedists forming the nucleus of a town, one small town in a world virtually without metals, circling the sun isolated from the rest of the galaxy, at the edge, the very edge. And now, 500 years later, we're a suburban world. The whole place is one big park with all the metal we want. We're at the center of everything now."
"Not really," said Kamphor. "We're still circling a sun isolated from the rest of the galaxy, still at the very edge of the galaxy."
"Ah, no. You're saying that without thinking. That was the whole point of this little Selden crisis. We are more than the single world of Terminus. We are the Foundation, which sends out its tentacles galaxy-wide and rules that galaxy from its position at the very edge. We can do it because we're not isolated, except in position, and that doesn't count."
"All right, I'll accept that."
Kamphor was clearly uninterested and took another step downward. The invisible cord between them stretched farther. Trevise reached out a hand as though to haul his companion up the steps again. "Don't you see the significance, Kamphor? There's this enormous change, but we don't accept it. In our hearts, we want the small foundation, the small one-world operation we had in the old days, the days of iron heroes and noble saints that are gone forever. Come on."
"I mean it. Look at Selden Hall. To begin with, in the first crises in Salvar Hardin's day, it was just the Time Vault, a small auditorium in which the holographic image of Selden appeared. That was all. Now it's a colossal mausoleum. But is there a force field ramp in the place, a slideway, a gravitic lift? No, just these steps, and we walk down them, and we walk up them, as Hardin would have had to do. At odd and unpredictable times, we cling in fright to the past." He flung his arm outward passionately. "Is there any structural component visible that is metal? Not one. It wouldn't do to have any, since in Salvar Hardin's day there was no native metal to speak of, and hardly any imported metal. We even installed old plastic, pink with age, when we built this huge pile, so that visitors from other worlds can stop and say, 'Galaxy, what lovely old plastic!' I tell you, Kamphor, it's a sham."
"Is that what you don't believe, then? Selden Hall?"
"And all its contents,"
said Trevise in a fierce whisper. "I don't really believe there's any sense in hiding here at the edge of the universe just because our ancestors did. I believe we ought to be out there in the middle of everything." "But Selden says you're wrong. The Selden plan is working."